Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I almost forgot where we were, Miranda.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible.
I forgot where we were because we have had some changes just in the last couple days.
It's been crazy. Yeah, it's been crazy around here.
Yeah. Do you want to explain about Andrew first?
Yeah. So Andrew got an awesome new job across the country. So yay for Andrew. He picked up and he moved across the country with his family and started a new job. Unfortunately, that means that he won't be joining us anymore on the Money Tree Podcast. Boo. And it's really sad because Andrew and I started this journey together. And so I'm going to miss him. And then Andrea, of course, was one of our great guests on the podcast. And then she became a regular panelist. And now she, too, has got some other great business opportunities that she is pursuing.
And she said she's kind of pivoting away from investing. So talking about investing, not really something that matches where she's headed.
Right. So things are changing around here, and we're excited. We've got some new cast members coming to join us. It's going to be super exciting. But until then,
this gives us an opportunity, Miranda, for two things. Number one, you and I to take a little bit of time off, which we haven't had.
That's true. And we are busy people.
I know. Tell me.
And then, makes you feel important if you could say you're busy, right?
I'm way too busy to be doing this. And then number two is this gives us an opportunity to play a few of our favorite episodes over the holidays.
So that's right.
These are way from the back catalog. So everybody have a happy holiday season. Miranda, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Joe. And best wishes for a new year where we all get to invest in our lives.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to another episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Larry Ludwig. Today we're going to be discussing how to get started with real estate investing. For those wanting to check out the show notes on our website, it's episode number 15. The URL for that is moneytreepodcast.com/15. Today, our guest host is Brandon Turner. Brandon is an active real estate investor who focuses both on rentals and flips. He's the VP of growth at biggerpockets.com, where he writes, does podcasts, and makes YouTube videos, and also hangs out with other real estate investors all day long. Let's welcome him to the program. So, Brandon, welcome to the show.
Larry, thank you so much. This is awesome. I'm glad to be here.
Me too. So let's start off with the basic questions. Let's let's imagine someone who's listening to this podcast who's just starting out investing and really not sure which way to go. What would you recommend as far as what's your favorite investment property?
Sure. So for me, I mean, this is going to be different for everyone, right? Like, there isn't one best investment, but there might be a best one for you, if that kind of makes sense. So for me anyway, and what I like, and I like to tell new investors, it's a term that I call house hacking. It's the idea of if you can combine your primary residence, like where you live, combine that with an investment into one thing, you kind of get, you know, two things for one. It's like a two for one sale. And so what that could look like, there's a couple ways that could look like. And I've done both actually starting out. My first property ever was this ugly house and needed, I think I bought it real cheap, like $80,000 or something like that. And it needed a fair amount of work. I bought it, fixed it up, and I sold it. I lived in it for a year and a half or something like that, or 2 years. No, not even that long. And whatever it was, a year and a half. And then I sold it and I made a decent profit off of it. I essentially flipped it, you know, the term, you know, those house flipping shows. I kind of flipped it while I was living in it. So that's kind of the one side of house hacking. The other side is what I did right after that is I went and bought a duplex and I lived in one of the units and I rented the other one out. And what I found was we charged $650 a month for rent for that front unit. My whole mortgage payment was $620 a month. And so I was technically getting paid to live for free. And that's kind of the concept of house hacking. And I think it's just a really valuable way for people to get started if that's like something that they can do. Now, that obviously not everyone can go and move into a property and, you know, make it happen. But for those who can, it really is a fabulous way to get started.
Well, now, I mean, one of the things that's interesting, I live in the Northeast, and with multifamily properties, I don't know how it is where you live in Seattle, but with multifamily properties, it's typically in not desirable areas or not the best areas where in other parts of the country, I know that's not necessarily the case. Was this two-family property in a decent area?
It was. I mean, it's okay. It's a very blue collar neighborhood. And, you know, at the time I was 21 years old, just getting started. So like for a 21 year old living in kind of a not shady neighborhood, but definitely lower income, that was perfectly fine for me because I was lower income. Like I fit in perfectly. Today I would not choose that same property. That said, I do. And like you said, it depends on where you live. But there are multifamilies, you know, in good areas.
Yeah.
What's more common, what I see, especially in like the Northeast, is the idea of like an income suite. Like there's that TV show Income Property with Scott McGillivray or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great show. It's on HGTV. And it's like this guy who basically remodels basement apartments or attics into separate units. That's a lot more common, I think, in the Northeast or in the East Coast in general as out here.
We're also mother-daughter too.
Yeah. It's really like they got – I just love those just separate units, those things which just work really, really well. And maybe you can't live for free. Maybe you can't live, you know, completely for free. But if you can offset your mortgage a little bit or majority-wise, I mean, you still got to find a good deal. You can't just go buy any multifamily property because it's sitting there for sale.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, but if you can find the right one, it can just be a powerful way to do it. And, you know, your renters are helping you pay your mortgage and you can take that money and go sink it into another investment and kind of tackle, yeah, like I said, 2-for-1 sale.
Now, in this multifamily, did you immediately go off to buy another property or how long did you buy your second property?
Sure. So it was quick. I think it was within 3 months I bought my second property.
Wow.
And that was a flip. Like I decided I wanted to be a house flipper. And so I, you know, was going to buy this house and fix it up and sell it. And so I bought the duplex. I lived in it. And then I wasn't, you know, didn't need to pay for housing anymore. So I quit my job at that point. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to be a full-time investor or full-time house flipper.
What time frame was this? Around 2001?
Yeah, this was actually 2007.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was right as the market was crashing. You know, like 2007, 2008 was when the market just kind of went down. And so I bought this as the market was collapsing. And I got a really good deal on the flip and ended up the market – I just couldn't – like even though we fixed the house up, I spent 9 months of my own like blood, sweat, and tears fixing the house up. And in the end, I couldn't chase the market fast enough. It was just dropping. The prices were dropping so quickly. We – ended up actually going to the bank and refinancing it and turning it into a rental property, which I still own today.
Hmm.
And ended up actually kind of discovering that I like rentals better than I like
flipping.
And I still do a little flipping here and there, but you know, I'm one of those, you know, when I eat Lucky Charms, I eat the marshmallows last, right? I eat the cereal first, yeah. Every single solitary one, and I wait until the end to get a big bite of marshmallow. That's kind of how I do my investing. I'm okay with the idea that rental properties are like the marshmallow at the end. You know, 30 years from now, I'm going to be fine. Flipping gives me the marshmallows right now. So
now, do you recommend – it sounds like you've done a lot of flipping or just in general a lot of renovation work on these properties. Do you recommend for someone just starting out, do you think – it makes sense to go with those type of needing a lot of work where you get a good discount on the price or something that's more complete?
I guess it kind of depends on the person's skill set. So me, like I didn't know what I was doing with my first house. I had never picked up a hammer in my life. But when I got that first deal, that very first house of mine, I went to Home Depot and I got this book called like 1-2-3 Home Improvement, right? And
yeah.
I learned how to do stuff and it fit my skill set. It fit my time availability. I was working a job that I had a lot of flexibility and time, like before the duplex, that first property, I was working this job where I worked overnights. And so I had all my whole days and I got to sleep at work. It was like the best job ever. Made minimum wage, but I got the sleep at work. That sounds like an awesome job. People are probably thinking it was actually working with like developmentally disabled adults. And so I just had to be there to supervise. But so for me, that fit my skill set and my time availability to be able to do the work myself. I don't necessarily recommend that for everybody. That said, I do recommend finding properties that need a little bit of work because it drops the competition. Now, what that level of work is depends on the person. So that first house of mine actually wasn't that bad. It really needed paint, needed carpet. It needed some new countertops. I did a little bit of tile work in the bathroom.
So really, cosmetic stuff.
Exactly, cosmetic. Now, I would not recommend that a brand new person go in involved in a property that needs a new foundation or, you know, it's like a tear down or a gut job down to the studs. I mean, that's a significant, you know, the more work you add to a project, the more opportunity you have for forgetting something or the more risk you have of, oh, I forgot about the insulation that goes in the walls. You know, like there goes 10 grand or I forgot about, you know, I didn't realize the roof was as bad as it was. Now there goes 15 grand. So the bigger projects you tackle and the bigger rehab, the more things that could go wrong. So yeah, I recommend definitely look for those cosmetic fixers. I always say this, my favorite thing when I walk into a property, if I walk into a property and it smells terrible, like my first thought is, smells like money. Because I love houses that smell bad because it's one of the easiest things to fix. But it's the thing that drives away 99% of the competition and can drive the price down, right? Like, I mean, a couple gallons of Kiehl's oil-based primer on the floor and ripping out the carpet will use, well, you know, carpet first, then Kiehl's oil-based on the floor. You know, and you don't have to do the work yourself. Hire a handyman to do it for $20 an hour. And that simple fix will eliminate 99% of smells in a property. And you get $10,000, $15,000, discount because of a bad smell. You know, all day long.
It's funny you bring up that story of smell because of my first property was a condo I bought for myself. And I walked into the property. The first thing I smelled was ferret. There was a ferret. I kid you not, a ferret in the corner of the living room.
Oh,
and there's all these. It was a major demo work where I needed to gut the whole entire place. But it was just a mess. So I got a great deal on it, though. I mean, I mean, literally it was probably $15,000 on the market at the time. The property itself went for about $120,000. So it was really a great deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, with that said, I had to put about $15,000 into it.
Yeah. And that is a real risk, right? Some people will do that. They'll buy a property, and I've done it. There's this one property I got. I call it my Pack Ave house. I also call it my hell house because I just don't like this house at all. But we bought it for $40,000 now. I mean, $40,000 is cheap, even in my area where we have cheaper prices. I live about an hour south of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we have, I mean, just cheap prices, but this was crazy cheap, $40,000. I ended up putting $45,000 into it. So I've got $85,000. I got a mortgage now for $85,000. The property is worth like $85,000. So what did I really do? I wasted 6 months of my life fixing up my house to have a house that was worth what, you know, what was into it. So I definitely, I mean, that's a risk you got to take. Some guy emailed me the other day, a friend of mine emailed me that exact question. He said, I don't know if I should rehab my house or not. And I said, you really got to look at what's your repair budget and what is it going to be worth afterwards to decide if it's worth that point. And definitely. I mean, it happens to people all the time. And so sometimes it doesn't make sense. Another thing that just to keep in mind, when you're buying those properties that aren't very pretty, that have those cosmetic problems, if it's too bad of condition, it's very, very hard to get a loan on it. So if you're not paying all cash, if you don't have the full cash you needed and you're going to go get a bank loan, the property needs to be in pretty good condition in order to get a bank loan. So just something for people to keep in mind as well.
Well, let's get on to it. It's kind of a good segue. What do you think is the biggest mistakes that people make when they're first starting to do real estate? Or what was some of the big mistakes you made that you wished you didn't do?
Sure. Number one mistake I think people make is probably jumping in without educating yourself first. And I don't mean like the education, you know, like late night TV guy, you know, selling the $9.97 a month product. Like I'm talking about the just reading books. I mean, when I got started, I read 100 books from my library, 100 books over a course of a summer. And that really helped me a lot. So that's not necessarily a mistake that I made, but I made plenty. I mean, the mistake that I made was not analyzing properties good enough. And that I see over and over and over again. I mean,
What do you mean by not analyzing enough?
What they do is a lot of people buy based on like emotion, or they go to a house and like, oh, this is so pretty. I'm going to buy this as a rental property. And they spend more time, you know, picking out their wardrobe for the day than they do deciding if they're going to buy this rental property.
Yeah.
And so they're clouded by the emotion. So I think, I mean, at very minimum, you should get into a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet or something, and really dive into the numbers and look at all the numbers too. And that kind of goes back to the education of what are all the numbers? What does that even mean? And there's a million books, there's blog posts, there's forums, there's podcasts, there's all the stuff about that. But if you forget little things, like here's a really good example. If you buy a house that gives you $100 a month in cash flow and you're like, great, you know, I got this property and at the end of the day, I'm making $100 a month. And then 10 years later, so you're making $100 a month, that's $1,200 a year, that's $12,000 over 10 years. 10 years go by and you got to put a new roof on the property. And the new roof cost you $12,000. So what did you really accomplish in those 10 years? Mm-hmm. Nothing, right? Like, because you didn't account for the fact that you needed a new roof. So that's called capital expenditures. And it's a number I set aside about 5% every month just for those big items that happen every 10 years or 15, 20 years. And so if you don't plan for those things, you don't do your analysis, and you don't look at it, then you can really dig yourself a nice hole and have yourself a nice income property that doesn't give you any income.
Well, I mean, you bring up a good point where not only compared to just doing an analysis on the property itself, but comparing to other types of investments. I mean, the way most people don't look at – they look at real estate as its own silo when in fact it should be really compared to other types of investments that are even more passive, like just putting into a bank as a CD. Granted, in this market right now, CD rates are very low, But at one point, we had CD rates much higher where you had to compare to, okay, does it make sense to me to invest in this property or to put it in a CD?
Yep. And I've fallen victim to that many times because I look at real estate like, you know, I love real estate. I love it. It's like my passion. Yet at the same time, I look at some of the properties. Now, generally, I like real estate because you don't have to do as much money. You can be a little more creative than you can in other investing. But the times that I have put some money into a deal, when I actually look at my ROI, it isn't that like – it doesn't blow me out of the water. I'm like, you know, I might make 10, 15% on ROI, which is good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like a lot of work went into making that 15% ROI or cash on cash. Cash return on investment, you know, a lot of work goes into that. So I've been thinking a lot lately about I need to diversify more and get into some more different types of investments. And, you know, you and I will talk about that some other time, I'm sure. But, you know, because, yeah, I think real estate is a good investment to diversify into, but it probably shouldn't be your one and only.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, in my case, I have currently one property, but I'm looking to expand at the moment, at least in the Northeast where I live. You know, I'm trying to stay in this area and try to invest in just locally. It's just very hard. The cap rates for what I'm looking for are just very low. I mean, partly because of the economic environment we're in right now with the Fed fund rates at zero pretty much. Yeah. It's almost impossible for me to find properties with a decent return on risk.
Yep. It is very, very tough. In a lot of areas, it's next to impossible. And so, I mean, there's a couple of choices people have. I mean, they could choose not to invest in that, you know, invest in something else, which is fine.
Yep.
Or they could choose to go elsewhere. And there are companies like, they call them turnkey companies. And essentially, you know, you could go to Dallas or Memphis or Ohio or wherever, you know, that have good cash flow properties. And you buy it from these companies and they will take care of the management. They'll take care of everything for you. And you can buy it that way. I mean, that's an avenue. I've never done it, but there are people that do it.
I've looked into that because that area, that type of investment actually interests me. Because I'm considering that as an option for myself personally.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something that is popular because of the issues I've mentioned, or is it because of, it's just something that makes it's easy in this day and age with technology to look at properties remotely and get, you know, decent return on investment outside of your local area.
Yeah, it very much is. I think, you know, I see a lot of investors from the coast, right, going inward into, you know, the Ohio or the Texas or the Pennsylvania, kind of the, maybe not Pennsylvania, but they got some good cash flow areas there. You know, like these areas that have much better cash flow. The Midwest in general has good cash flow compared to the both sides of the country, the coasts. But I think the hard part with that, and the reason that I've never jumped in yet, is because you really have to trust. Because you don't know the area. I mean, right? Like even in your own area, yeah, you go one block the wrong way and all of a sudden you're in an area you don't want to buy in. And how do you know that if you don't live there? So a lot of it comes down to trust. Do you trust the company that you're buying from? Do you trust the people? Do you, or what are you going to do to verify that all? I know a good way that a lot of people I've seen do, at least like on BiggerPockets, is they'll connect with another person in another area. Like I got a friend, Mehran, who lives in LA. I mean, he can't invest in LA. It's way too expensive. There's no cash flow. The cap rates are terrible. But he went and partnered with this person who lived in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And they invest, and she's like the boots on the ground, and he provides more of the capital needed. And they buy these $30,000 or $40,000 houses that are renting for $800-$900 a month. I mean, that there's incredible cash flow on these properties, but they buy them. So he's doing it remotely. So that's another avenue as well. If you don't want to go through the big company, you could do it yourself. And having somebody with boots on the ground is a good way to do it.
Yeah, I've considered that because in some parts of the country, like you said, it's a no brainer. I mean, you literally can make your money back in a few years.
Yeah.
And the only problem is, like you said, the management issues, you're just not there locally. But from a cash flow perspective, it's almost an you're almost stupid not to do it. It's almost hard to pass up. So I've been looking at that as an option for myself personally. But yeah, I have not done that yet.
Yeah, it makes sense. And the other thing too is like when you invest in, I mean, there's two different types of investing, right? Maybe we should preface it with this. Like there's people that invest for cash flow. There's people that invest for appreciation when it comes to real estate. Mm-hmm. And so those markets, like especially in the Midwest, are cash flow markets. My market that I live in is a cash flow market. I don't expect prices to go up ever. I mean, sure, they probably will. They'll go up with inflation maybe, but I don't expect prices to go up. But you go down to, San Francisco.
San Francisco is a great example.
Yeah. And they're climbing like, They climb more in a month than I'll climb in the next 5 years, like in percentage of their property value. This is how they do. They just, and people investing there are getting no cash flow. They might even be losing money, but it's their hope that prices are going to go up to be able to make them a lot of money in the long run through appreciation. Now, I tend to tell people don't invest for appreciation, especially when you're starting out. If you're trying to diversify and you got a lot of extra cash and you don't mind the risk, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's something I want to get into eventually, is more of the appreciation gamble. But you know, I think the cash flow is a lot nicer to be able to look at a spreadsheet and say, here's where we are today. Here's where we'll be in 5 years, 10 years, rather than just throwing it in on a risk that, you know, Las Vegas or LA or whatever is going to shoot up in price over the next few years.
Yeah. Now, do you think most people fall in love with the numbers, or do you think, is that the big mistake that most people, when they do the, I think we kind of alluded to this, that a lot of people, you know, fall in love with the property and don't look at the numbers. Do you think that's the yeah. biggest issue or not?
I do. I think it's huge. I think people get so excited about wanting to invest in real estate, and they watch the TV shows, whether it's a flipping show or the other, you know, anything on HGTV, and they get excited about the prospect of real estate. Because, I mean, like, most people admit that looking at a, you know, three bedroom, two bath house with granite countertops is a lot sexier than looking at a spreadsheet from, you know, T. Rowe Price or whatever. You know, like, it's just, it's a totally more emotional game. Like, you really get involved in it.
Well, it's stuff you can actually feel and hold and touch. I mean, that's unlike a mutual fund, you can't hold a touch. You can look at a piece of property and go, ooh, you know, like you said, it has granite countertops.
Yep.
You know, it's got the nice kitchen. It's got all the things that you can, as far as you personally would like to live in.
Yep. And I think there's an ego thing that goes in there too, right? Like, very, you're not going to like go around and show people, hey, this is my, you know, my portfolio right now. I've got, you know, a little bit of Apple stock and I got a little bit of this stock. Like, nobody does that, but everybody talk, hey, I got this property over here. You know, here's this property over here. This is mine. You know what this is? Like, I think there's definitely an ego thing that comes in too, is I'm excited to buy real estate because I can show it off to my family and friends and show that I'm actually doing cool stuff. And, you know, that can lead you into trouble too, because then you're buying just for the sake of buying. You're not buying for the sake of an investment, which again circles back to the idea of the mistake people make. Is they don't do enough analysis. They don't sit down and actually pencil out the numbers to figure out where they'll actually are going to be.
Well, the funny thing is, a lot of these shows on HGTV that you talked about, like Income Property, they talk about the whole pre-phase of building, you know, rebuilding the property, getting it to where it is rentable. But they rarely talk about the issues after the fact of, like, okay, you got a bad tenant. What do you do with that tenant to kick them out?
Yep.
And that's the funny part. They talk about all the sexy part of it, of, you know, remodeling, you know, getting the you know, finding a property that's appropriate, actually figuring out what the rental value should be and all that stuff. But they don't talk about, okay, we actually have a tenant in here. What happens next?
Yep. And you asked about mistakes earlier, and this is another huge mistake people make, and I've made it many times. It's the idea of treating your landlording as a hobby, not a business.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, I'm just going to kind of do it willy-nilly and, you know, whatever, my tenant calls. You know, it's, you would never run your business like that if you own, you know, you own a mail shipping company, or you own a box company, or you own whatever. Like, a successful business is run with systems and processes and people, and there's, you know, it's run like a business if you want to be successful. And landlording should not be any other way than that. I mean, little examples of that would be if your tenant is calling you, you know, at 9 o'clock at night to complain about, I don't know, some like issue that's not really an issue, and you're taking those phone calls and you're dealing with it. You know, again, the guy that works at the UPS store down the street, he's not answering his phone at 9 o'clock at night to deal with why is his shipment not getting there. I mean, he sets hours, and that's just one very simple example of kind of a process you have. It's setting boundaries and rules and having an idea of what you're going to do if something goes wrong.
I agree. I mean, one of the things most people, I think, make the mistake with investing in real estate is it is totally passive, and it's not. It is a mix. No. Is it really a hybrid between owning an active business and something that's totally passive? It's somewhere in between. And I mean, granted, you can do a lot of processes in place to minimize the activity that you have to do for that property, but still, it's something that has to be maintained. It has stuff that breaks down. I mean, no property is totally foolproof. Either you have to hire someone to do the work, or you have to do it yourself.
Yep. Even if you got a property manager to take care of it, and you're one of those out-of-state investors, you know, doing a turnkey thing, you still have to manage your manager. You still have to do the numbers. You still have to make sure that they're doing their job. And it definitely is not passive. I wrote a post a long time ago, and I used the word the scale of passivity. And like, no matter where you fall on that scale, you still are never going to be fully passive with real estate. I mean, you can try to find ways to make it more or less, you know, passive. And generally, the rule of thumb is the less passive, the more money you make. I mean, there's guys that are buying up these houses in Detroit for like $4,000, you know, like, and those are, I can guarantee you, are not going to be very passive for them, you know, dealing with that drama. But they're okay with that. They bought themselves a job or a business, and it works for them, and it works for them. Great. But, you know, don't go into an investment thinking it's going to be passive, because it seldom is.
Now, what do you think, as far as we talked about a little bit, remote management of properties? Do you think, is that something you currently do, or is that something you recommend? I mean, I think that's something more for an advanced investor. If they've just started in their local market, they want to expand. But is that something you think makes sense for someone who's getting more to the advanced stages?
I think, so I do not currently do it. Everything that I own was within a 45-minute drive of where I live right now. That said, I'm not opposed to the idea of doing it as long as I knew the market and I knew somebody there. And what I mean by that is the idea of, you know, if I went and bought in Texas, you know, Texas is a decent cash flow market and they also got decent appreciation. And there's, you know, a lot of people like Texas for investing right now in real estate.
Yeah.
So if I were to go do that, and I would just go, you know, point to a map and pick a town and go and buy something in that town. I think there's a mistake in that I wouldn't know who the good handymen are. I mean, it is exceptionally difficult to find good people to do work for you. It's exceptionally difficult. So trying to do that from 2,000 miles away is, you know, near impossible. I mean, you can't screen these people. Like half the time they don't show up. Do you just give them a key to the property? How does all those things happen when you're far away? So again, it can be done with the right systems and processes, or if you have a partner or you know somebody. You know, I grew up in Minnesota when I was a kid. And so I've been looking at investing in Minnesota simply because I've got a massive family connection out there. So I can go on my Facebook and say, hey, I'm looking for a tile guy in the Twin Cities area. Anybody know anybody? So I have that connection there. So I'd be okay with remotely managing from here, only in Minnesota. I wouldn't really feel comfortable anywhere else at this point because I don't have the connections.
Yeah. I mean, which you also bring up a very good point, though. Why, and this is something I've always wondered, contractors in general are just really horrible. They're not reliable. Why is that? I mean, I've dealt with so many contractors over the years, both for personal and professional. And it's just, like you said, some don't show up. They don't show up on time, or you ask them to do something that's very specific in a certain way and they don't do it, or they do it their own way for whatever reason. Why do you think that is? Why do you think contractors in general are not, as far as a business, is not very professional? I don't know why that is.
Well, you know, I was actually a contractor for a short time. I mean, like short, like a few months. I went and got my contractor's license and thought, well, I'm doing the flipping thing anyway. I might as well do it for other people.
Yeah.
And my theory was that exact thing. I thought, every single contractor I've ever known, they don't return phone calls. They don't schedule right. They're late. If they even show up, they're half the time they're hungover. So I mean, that was my theory, is I'm going to do better than that. And I think maybe I did a little. I just realized very quickly I hated contracting, so I quit that. But I think there's like, actually, this ties in perfectly what we talked about earlier. When you're running a business, you got to treat it like a business. That's the problem I think contractors have, is they're not business people. They're good at fixing something, and that's about it. So it's kind of, if you've ever read The E-Myth.
That's exactly what I'm going to say.
Yeah, yeah, they might be a good baker, but it doesn't mean they're good at running a bakery.
Nope.
You know, they might be good at fixing a door, but they're not good at running a door-fixing company. And there's like two completely opposite skills to have, or completely different skills to have, and it's hard to find people with both those skills.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard over the long term. I've only had a few contractors I've liked that have done good work, and also, like you said, have the business skills to understand it. You know, they got to treat it like a business and not give you a quote that's on a piece of paper that's not, you know, just handwritten.
Yep.
I've had ones that not even give me verbal quotes. I'm like, no, I want it written down so I know exactly what I'm getting.
Yep. And that's a mistake. I mean, I've made over and over and over, and I continue to make it all the time, is I get contractors to do work for me, and then later on they do the work, and then at the end of the project I go look at it and there's something, you know, like ridiculously wrong. Like, hey, I'm going to put in this door for you. And then I go look at the door and it's not painted. And I'm like, well, you got to paint the door. And they're like, oh, that wasn't part of the bid. And I look at it and all the bid says is install door. And I'm like, dang it. Like, what does that mean? Like install, like, let's get specific here. And I blame myself for that. Like, why didn't I ask for clarification? And maybe I'm getting better at it, but this is a mistake that people make all the time with contractors, is not getting specific enough and not making them treat their own business like a business.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's change gears a little bit. Let's talk about your new book. You have a book called Investing in Real Estate with No or Low Money Down. What prompted you to write this book?
Sure. Like I said earlier, almost the thing I like about real estate is the ability to kind of trade your cash for creativity. Like, you can be creative and invest without having to use a lot of cash. And there's a lot of different methods of doing that. But kind of what sparked this is I get a lot of emails all the time from people who say, I want to get started investing in real estate. I don't have much money to start with. You know, is there any hope for me? And so, you know, when looking around, you know, no money down is kind of a, you know, a term that's kind of scammy, kind of weird, like late night TV, greasy hair, you know, kind of thing. Like, that's what people think of when they think of no money down. And as such, there's like this debate, is no money down is a scam, or is it possible? And so when I kind of started to put together my thoughts down on paper, and it started out as a long blog post and then turned into a book, the idea that there is no one method. There's no like, this is the secret method to invest in with, you know, little down or no money down. Like there is no one method. What works for me won't necessarily work for you. And that could be because of your skill set, could be because of your personality, could be because of your location. Things are very different. So anybody who ever says like, here's how you invest in real estate with no money down, I mean, they're lying to you or they're not giving you the full information. And so kind of what my theory was let me just write down everything that I've done. I mean, I've been doing this for 9 years now, and I have close to $2 million worth of real estate, and I've maybe put in less than $15,000 my entire life into anything. And that money I've even gotten back after refinances. So I know it's possible because I've done it. So I just said, well, let me just write a chapter about every strategy that I've personally done and talk about how it's done. And then people can mix and match and come up with their own ideas of how they can work for them.
Well, I'm assuming most people go up to you and go, you know, no money down is a myth. It's just not possible. Do you have actual professional investors say that or not?
I tend to think this: the more advanced an investor becomes, the less money they use of themselves. I mean, like if you think of like the big time investors in our world, I mean, like the Donald Trumps and guys like that, like they very, very seldom use their own money, if ever, in a property. So the more advanced you get, the less money of your own you use, simply because once you get good enough to be able to do these larger deals and do multiple deals on a lot of them, your own money runs out a lot quicker than your ability to find deals are. And so you're kind of forced to to scale your business, you're forced to use other people's money. And so there's definitely strategies for doing it. It's not like there's a simple loan, you go to the bank and there's a no money down loan. And I mean, there are two loans currently, the VA loan or the USDA loan, that will give you zero down. But, you know, those are pretty difficult to obtain unless you fit their little box. But yeah, I think it just, I don't know, kind of just comes down to, for some people, one strategy will work, some strategies another one will work. And as you become a better investor, you learn these strategies and you mix and match them together.
What do you think for someone just starting out, if they want to do no money down, what do you recommend?
Sure.
The easiest or simplest way to start?
Yeah, the easiest way kind of ties in what I said earlier about the idea of house hacking. So one of my favorite strategies is there's a loan called an FHA loan. Basically what that means is it's a owner-occupied loan, meaning you have to live in the property, but they only require 3.5% down. So if you want to buy a $100,000 property, you only got to pay $3,500, you know, plus closing costs and whatever else. You're probably in about $5,000. You know, that's a pretty low down way to invest. The great thing about the FHA loan is that they allow you to do that with a single family house or a duplex, a triplex, or a fourplex.
Really?
So in other words, yeah, you can go out and find a fourplex and go and live in one of the units and then rent the other three out, and you get a low down fixed rate 30-year mortgage on today's crazy low interest rates. And when you move out, it doesn't, like, as long as you live there for a year, I think that's generally the requirement, is a year. But when you move out, you don't have to refinance. You get to keep that loan in place at that low interest rate, fixed rate forever. And it's really just a fabulous way. And then as a even cooler kind of side of that, there's a subset of this FHA loan called a 203K loan. And what that does is it says it's the same thing, 3.5% down, but they allow you to wrap all the repair costs into the loan. So let's say you got that $100,000 property, it's a duplex prices are relative, so, you know, multiply this times whatever you need to for your area. But let's say there's a $100,000 duplex that needs $50,000 worth of work. Well, normally you'd have to go and buy that property for 100 down or 100,000. You'd have to put 20% down, like a typical loan, and then you got to pay 50 grand out of pocket to fix it up. So you're in 70 grand. That's a lot of money. That's like a typical investor. But if you want to be creative, the 203K loan will add the two numbers together. 100 plus 50 is 150, and you'll just pay 3.5% of that total amount. And then you can, again, live in the property. And then after a year, you can move out, you can sell it, you can do whatever you want. So that there's some magic to happen in that. And that's that whole concept of house hacking. And it's not necessarily no money down, unless, again, you're a veteran and you get a VA loan. But it's definitely low money, and you could probably get into a property for a lot cheaper than people think.
Now, with the FHA loans, are they really complicated in terms of getting approval or not? I've not done one myself.
They're not too bad. I would actually say they're probably easier than a lot of loans to get, but they do have a little bit more paperwork and a little more things to kind of look into. Like, for example, the house has to have an inspection and it has to be in halfway decent shape. Like, it has to be pretty good. Like, little thing.
It has to be livable, in other words.
It has to be livable, yeah. They got to have smoke detectors. The windows have to be certain, you know, in the bathroom has to have a window or a vent. And there's all these like little rules that they'll do an inspection. Now, again, if you have the 203K loan and you can add those repairs in, then it doesn't really matter. But just from an FHA standpoint, the house does have to be in halfway decent condition. But FHA does allow fairly – I don't remember the current number. I'm not a mortgage person, but I think it's like a low 600 credit score. So it's fairly you know, you don't have to have perfect, you know, 800 credit to be able to qualify these kind of things. They're kind of designed for people who are just starting out. And you can only have one. So I will say that you can't do this forever. Yeah. You can only have one at a time. So if you do one, you can then sell it or refinance it and do it again.
But you can do it again, though.
Yeah, you can do it again. And so you can do it multiple times if you need to, you know. And another kind of cool thing that a lot of people do is there's a rule, and again, I'm not a CPA, so you know, talk to your CPA about this. But there is an exception in the IRS code that says if you live in a property for 2 years, you don't have to pay capital gains taxes when you sell.
Yep.
Meaning that if you make a nice big profit, so kind of combining that idea of house hacking with that, if you buy a property, use a 203K loan to fix it up. So you're not using your own money; you're using the bank's money to fix it up. You live in it for 2 years, you sell it, you make a nice big chunk. Now, not only are you being able to live, you know, in the, you know, flip this house that you're living in, you also get that money tax free.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's some massive benefits to doing that.
One more question before I let you go. Sure. This is I guess one of the things that I question right now currently in the interest rate environment, since it's so artificially low, do you think this is a good thing or do you think it's going to hurt the markets for the long run? I mean, granted, prices have somewhat creeped up again. They're mm-hmm. not where they were in, say, 2007. But do you think we're right now with the low interest rate environment, is it something where if they go back to more normal rates or if they can go back to normal rates, do you think that's going to hurt the housing market?
I do, actually. I mean, I'm not much of an economist here, but like when I just think of like the logic behind it, like, you know, the market is slowly improving, but it kind of feels like it's improving because it's being forced to improve.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're setting ourselves up for this. If we ever stop that point, you know, their hope is, of course, that the economy kicks in because of that and that it can support itself at that point. I mean, that hasn't happened yet, I don't believe. Like, I think today, if all of a sudden rates went up to 8%, I think we'd see a massive drop in people buying houses.
Yeah.
Until they can afford that 8% payment. Or we'd just see a massive, you know, shift from doing, you know, bank loans to people doing private lending or people doing seller financing and kind of those techniques that used to be popular when rates were high.
But if you're investing for cash flow, it's not as much of an important issue than, say, if you're trying to invest for appreciation.
Yeah, yeah, because that's, I mean, so going back to that duplex, this is a good story. So the duplex that I bought, that very, very first rental property I owned, ended up, you know, the payment was $620 a month. And so the thing that I like about this house, on a side note, this is actually Kurt Cobain, like, you know, the rock star Kurt Cobain from Nirvana. This was his very first house, which we didn't discover until years later. Yeah, so it's just kind of a neat.
It's like a shrine.
It's like a neat side note, but. So I wrote this post one time called How I Bought Kurt Cobain's First Two Houses, because it was a duplex and he lived in both halves. How I Bought Kurt Cobain's First Two Houses and Why That's Not the Best Part. And the point of the article was the best part was the fact that no matter what the market does, I mean, I bought that pre-crash. Like I bought it like when the market was at the peak. I don't care. It doesn't matter. I mean, the market could tank tomorrow. That property could be worth nothing tomorrow. But rents rarely drop, if ever, because rents are tied to minimum wage.
Yep.
And so, or at least in my area, you know, rents are tied to the economy and my economy is minimum wage. And so I don't have to worry about rents dropping as much. And so no matter what the economy does, no matter what interest rates do, I've got a fixed rate mortgage on that property forever. And so again, that goes back to the appreciation thing. I don't invest for appreciation because, you know, I like the my goal was to get enough cash flow to be able to quit my job, never have to work again, and you relax, you know, for the rest of my life, which is my priorities have kind of shifted a little bit recently, but that was kind of the goal. So now I'm thinking, well, if I want to become a billionaire, I got to get into the appreciation game. But if I want to be a millionaire, you know, cash flow will get you there. And again, it's more secure. You don't have to worry about external factors like the economy quite as much.
Yeah. Awesome interview. I guess in terms of where should people reach you if they want to find out more about yourself or more about Bigger Pockets?
Sure. You know, they can hit me up on Twitter. It's Brandon at BP, like at Brandon at BP. BiggerPockets.com is the website that I hang out on 24/7 pretty much. And I write there and I have a podcast there. And if they want to get that invest in real estate with no and low money down, they just go to BiggerPockets.com/no money.
And you're also on Amazon as well, the book, right?
It is. It is on Amazon as well. So
awesome.
Cool.
Thank you, Brandon.
All right, well, hey, thank you, Valeria. This was awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Well, welcome to another roundtable portion of the program. We have, as our roundtable guests, we have Andrew Sather of eInvesting for Beginners, Nick Krackman for ValueSpreadsheet.com, Miranda McQuitt for PlantingMoneySeeds.com, and of course, me, Larry Ludwig from Investor Junkie. So guys, what did you think of the interview? I mean, I guess let's start off with the first question that I want to ask you guys. Do you think compared to other investment options, do you think investing in real estate is a good idea? And if so, why? If not, why also? Let's start with, let's start with Miranda first, since I know she hates real estate.
I don't hate it. I think having some exposure to real estate, there's nothing wrong with that. I invest in a REIT, a real estate investment trust.
What type of REIT though? Is it a Vanguard or like a generic overall market REIT or a specific REIT?
Yeah, so it is, it's the extra storage space. And so it's actually one of those that like invests in like storage units.
Okay.
So it's more like a commercial real estate kind of a thing. So that's what I invest in as far as my real estate exposure, but that's not the same thing as like buying real estate. I'm not a big fan of buying real estate because it comes with a lot of management responsibilities, and we all know by now that I am just lazy. So there's too much management that goes into it and too much stress, and it's not, you know, my thing. But I think having a little real estate exposure in your portfolio does make sense. Just for, you know, diversity. And I like having the REIT because it pays dividends. So,
It's interesting. I mean, you're obviously a big fan of Betterment. Betterment does not, in fact, have any REIT in their portfolio. And they said, actually, historically, they show it does not, it's not a significant diversifier, which I kind of disagree with that statement. But yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's why I have to keep it someplace else because it's obviously not coming from my Betterment portfolio. So,
exactly.
But it is nice to have. I do like having the dividends because of the way the REIT is set up, a very large proportion. I think 90% of what they bring in, I'd have to double check that, but because of the way they're structured, a very large portion of the earnings have to be paid out.
It's with any REIT, I believe it's 80% or something, something along those lines. I don't know the exact number. It's really high, yes. Andrew, what are your thoughts?
The way I look at real estate is kind of when I started out in investing, I always had it as an end goal. Like I want, you know, I have my investments now in the stock market, but I want to eventually be able to get into real estate for the reasons that were discussed previously. I mean, it's tangible, it's there, and it's kind of a less volatile in the sense that, you know, if you buy a piece of real estate with cash and you own that piece of real estate, I mean, I feel like you have more control over it than you would like just any stock. So in that sense, I like real estate, but I think a lot of people get into trouble with real estate when they try to get creative and, you know, see it as this sort of golden ticket without considering, you know, if you can get into a lot of debt with real estate and really get yourself into trouble. And then at that point, you're not investing, you're speculating. And I see a lot of people who with good intentions that kind of go down that path. And
well, it's more of a business. I mean, it's not passive in the sense of a traditional investment. You invest in it and just watch it grow or not, where you have to be actively involved, and not necessarily day to day, but in some form, at least one, you know, maybe possibly once a month or certain times during a month.
Right. Yeah.
Nick, what about in your case? I mean, granted, in your country, it's a little different as far as the real estate, and obviously real estate's very local. Have you considered investing in real estate in your country? And if so, yes, or if not, why not?
I have decided that it's not my cup of tea. And for, I think, yeah, two reasons is that it ties up a lot of money. And for me personally, it seems that buying a house with a mortgage is the same as investing with leverage. And I'm just not a big fan of that. But there are definitely situations in which real estate investing can be a great way to invest your money. I mean, a good example for me personally is Kevin Green, who is a self-made millionaire, and he's actually one of the biggest landlords in the UK. And he earned his first money by flipping houses. And yeah, and another good way to earn money from real estate investing, which I got from Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad Poor Dad, is just to buy a couple of places, rent them out, but then hire someone to manage those properties for you. Because that's also what Miranda said, that the management part is just, yeah, it's not optimal. But if you can hire someone to do that who is good at his job, it takes away a lot of the stress. But yeah, obviously not many people have enough money to pursue a strategy like this because of the enormous investments required. But yeah, there are situations that it's an interesting way to put your money to work.
Now, do you think as far as, Brandon talked about as far as maybe starting with your first house and investing that, consider that as an investment. But let's ask, we talked about it in another podcast as well. Do you consider your house, your primary real estate as an investment? If so, why?
Well, if you follow the house hacking strategy that you guys explained talked about during the interview, then yeah, it's sort of your house is an investment. But generally, a house is at least to me more a liability than an investment. At least your own house, because you know many people end up working all their lives to pay for something they will never own, and. I mean, the house prices do not always go up, but that's also true for stock prices. But yeah, your own house, you should not look at it as an investment, in my opinion.
Let's start with, before I go to Miranda, because I know her opinion, let's go to Andrew first.
Yeah, I totally agree with Nick. You know, when you have a house, even if it does go up in value, once you sell, chances are that house prices around the country are going to be up as well. And so any gain in investment you might have made is not going to be as substantial if house prices tend to all go together. I think a lot of it has to do with location too. I mean, the house hacking idea sounds really great. I mean, I would love to do that for myself, but it really depends on your location. The coast. What's that?
In your area of the country, in Southern California, it's pretty much impossible.
Yeah, I don't see any multifamily homes at all. And, you know, prices are so high that a lot of my peers might be jumping into these things where they're getting huge mortgages and huge liabilities and they're kind of trapping themselves in this part of the country and they can't ever, you know, go out. So I see it. It's not viable for me, but I could see how other people maybe see that possibility.
And if anything, in your part of the country, it might be cheaper to rent than actually own a piece of property.
Yeah, depending on where you rent, yeah, and how nice or how crappy you can deal with, you know, the location, but yeah.
All right, Miranda, what's your opinion?
Oh, we had a huge rant on this a couple weeks ago. Viewing your own house as a financial investment, I think, does not work. As Nick pointed out, your mortgage it's a liability. It's draining your finances, even with the tax deduction that you get. The tax deduction does not make up for it. And so viewing it as a financial investment is not the best idea. I can understand why some people could see it as an emotional investment, you know, a stable place to raise your family, something that you can do whatever you want with. You could paint whatever color you want, you know, put up pictures, all that kind of stuff, do what you want to the yard. So I can see why some people would like owning their home from like an emotional standpoint. But even if you stay in your home for 30 years, the chances, if you're in a hot market and you buy your home and you keep it for 30 years, you might be able to sell it at and see a return down the road. But chances are, for most people in a kind of a, you know, middle market kind of a thing where it's, they're not on the coast, they're not seeing a huge appreciation each year, even over 30 years, your return is going to be eroded by, you know, inflation, by the interest that you pay, the taxes that you pay, your maintenance, your repairs, all that stuff adds up, and you'll honestly be lucky to break even, I think. So I don't know. I mean, I guess the appeal is when you're done, you can have this big chunk of cash and then you can go do something else with it if you sell your house. And from that standpoint, I guess it could be valuable. But
if I could add something too, I think it's a lot of it, so much of it's timing too, because you get people with stories who, you know, just happen to buy at the bottom because that's when they're looking at homes and then just happen to sell at the top. And then they're like, wow, look at this. I made X percent, and so you know it's a great investment. That's the truth for them. But you know, real estate's just as you know it's going to go up or down just like anything else. I mean, talk to gold bugs and silver bugs back in 2009 and 2010, and they said, "Oh yeah, it always goes up." I mean, and now you know, look at it today with it, you know, just crashing down. And so you know, people used to say the same thing about real estate, and it's really with any market, you just have to really understand that these things go up and down.
Well, let's make an analogy to value investing. I mean, Brendan and I didn't talk about it in the podcast interview, but there is a ratio to rent to actual prices of real estate, and where there are markets where it's overheated, it doesn't make sense to actually buy a property, and you're better off to rent. And that ratio, if it, just like you know, value investing, if you really have to know where the bottom of the market is or where you think the direction of that market will go, so you kind of have to do some basic logic and also reasoning to determine whether or not to buy a property, but it's not totally mystic where it's, you don't know what the valuation of that market is. A great example right now in the country is San Francisco Bay Area is just ridiculous. I mean, for anyone to buy a property there, expecting it to get another, say, 20, 30, 40% in the next few years is ridiculous. It's just not going to happen because the rent ratio is just so ridiculously off. So therefore, there are certain parts of the area, the country, it doesn't make sense to, you're better off renting. I mean, I'm definitely all for that.
Yeah, that's what you discussed as well, right? That many people purchase based on emotion rather than on objective criteria. But there are objective criteria. You just need to consider those. And because, you know, the same thing happens on the stock market. People let their emotions guide them. And that's the number one reason people lose money. So the same thing happens with houses, obviously, or with properties.
Well, especially your primary residence. I mean, out of anything, you get so emotional over a primary residence. Where investment property, you try not to. But even then, as Brendan and I talked about, we kind of still do, though.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And so that's value investing, too. I mean, you talk about comparing rents to the real estate value. That's exactly what you're doing with value investing. You have these ratios that me and Nick teach, and it's what these ratios will do. It's not the number, it's the proportion to, you know, so for each company, it's going to be a little bit different, but it's those ratios that will tell you that if you're getting a good deal or not. And it's not some crazy mystical thing. It's something you can look up. It's been researched, and you can compare within companies and within industries, you know, to really find the great deals. And, you know, obviously you can do the same with real estate.
So we talked about some of the risks involved. We kind of alluded to them. What do you think specifically are the risks with real estate? Let's start with you first, Andrew.
Obviously, number one, you know, you can lose money, and people all across the country have seen that. I think a big thing too is just getting overly optimistic. You know, there was the example of Donald Trump and how great he's doing with real estate. But that guy's been bankrupt like 4 or 5 times. And, you know, the average person trying to follow what he does is not going to be able to survive. And, you know, he's really just building his brand and kind of leveraging these bankruptcies. But most of us out there, if we were to get bankrupt, that would really cripple us financially. So I think it's important to understand that there's so many different ways that you can invest in real estate, and so much creative things you can do with other people's money. But the more creative you get, the much more risk that you bring onto yourself. And those are the stories that people don't talk about when, you know, when you're leveraging up, you're building up really great big portfolios, but at the same time, you're not thinking about the risk and what the downside could be. And like Warren Buffett says, you know, when the tide goes down, you really see who's not wearing pants. And, you know, I really caution people who want to jump into real estate to not think that, you know, you can just magically build all this capital using all these other people's money and that nothing bad's going to happen to you. It's all about timing. But I think if you want to build a successful portfolio, you have to do it over a very long period of time.
Nick, what are your thoughts?
Well, when it comes to risks, when we're talking about real estate, I think one of the main issues is that the general consensus seems to be that buying a house is the best investment you can ever make, and that it's a very safe investment. But people tend to forget, or they forget to account for the fact that there are massive opportunity costs involved, because you just You know, you lock up a lot of money in that investment, if you can even call it an investment. And the fact that house prices do not always go up in value, but property taxes generally do. So those are things to consider. And yeah, that failing to account for them is definitely a big risk.
And Miranda, your thoughts?
Yeah, really just, you know, what the rest of these guys have been saying. I mean, your biggest risks are going to be what happens when the property goes down and what you're going to have to do to take care of it. You know, and then I think Nick made a really good point earlier on when he said it ties up your capital. It takes a big chunk of money to invest in real estate. And so that kind of ties it up, and you could be doing something else with that capital and maybe investing it in something that will provide you with a better return down the road than real estate.
Great closing. So guys, if this is a great episode again, if you want to find out the show notes, go to moneytreepodcast.com/15. And in the end, remember, no one cares more about your money than you do. And have a great day, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.